All right, we're beginning on the top of Kuvvav and Aleph, four lines down. Amalei, person says, Zarachiti, the agreement between the parties was that he was going to plant wheat, Vazalhu Vizarasare, and instead he planted barley. So back again to the Mishnah, the question revolves around whether this is considered a Makat Medina, or is this a problem for this individual. The burden of proof is on the Chocher here, because the only reason he gets a reduction in price is because he proves that it was totally out of his control. Otherwise, in the technicalities of the contract, the chocher is always chayav to pay the fixed amount, given the fact that he rented the field without any connection to the output of the field. So therefore, the determination in all these cases, and that's what we went through yesterday, was whether it's classified as a makat medina, or is it classified as a personal problem. So over here, they had agreed that he was going to plant wheat, and instead he plants barley. V'ishtodof ruba debago. V'ishtodof nami hanach sare delay. Meantime, this blast came along, destroyed his field, the one that he's planting with barley, but it also destroyed the majority of the bika, according to Rashi, according to the Rambam's yesterday's interpretation, majority of the fields in that area, that village, that city. So it seems that it has nothing to do with the crop that he picked. It has to do with the fact that it wiped out everything in that area. So mi amrinin da amarle, do we say that can the sharecropper say to the landlord, da amarle, ilu zarata chite avanami mishtadfa, had I planted wheat, it would have made no difference, because look at the rest of the area. Everybody lost their fields. So why are we any different? And just because I planted barley, was not anything that changed the dynamic of what was going on with the field. Oh, Dilma Amatsi Amarle, or maybe the landlord can retort and say, Ilu Zarata Chite, had you planted it wheat, Havi Mikayim Bi, this Pasuk would have come true for me. Pasuk from Iov, it's Eliphaz the Temani who's speaking there, and he's describing how a person needs to do tshuva, believe in Hashem, rely on Hashem, and then if you do rely on Hashem, there are certain things that will happen. One of those things that happens is, V'tigzar omer v'yokam lach. You will make requests, you will decree, and Hashem will do your bidding. He says, Hashem would have done my bidding. Rashi explains to us, Ma shetivakesh min ha-yotzer yaseh. Whatever you ask of God, He'll do. V'ani lo bakashti min ha-shamayim b'tchilat ha-shana, she'etzlicheni b'sorim ele b'chitin. I thought we were planting wheat. So I daven to Hashem that my wheat should do well. Meantime, you planted barley. And so therefore, Hashem's protection was not provided over here because I davened for something else. Had I known we were planting barley, then I would have davened for that. So now that you planted barley, my tefillot or my requests were meaningless. But had you planted the right thing, actually our field would have survived. And my tefillot would have been answered. Therefore, it's not considered to be a makat medina. You ruined the possibility of this field being saved. Amar says, Mistavra, it makes sense to conclude, Damale, Izarata Chite, had you planted a wheat, Amemekayim bi, V'tigzar omer, V'yokim lach, and here's the end of the Pasuk, V'ad Virachecha Naga'or, and all of your ways Hashem will shine light on, meaning it's a Pasuk that basically says that the individual will be able to walk a path of success because Hashem responds to his tefillot, and sheds a light on everything that he does. So the Gemara concludes, and again, it has to do with the nature of the burden of proof here. The burden of proof is on the Chocher to show that he is really amongst a Makat Medina, and not something particular that happened here. If the landlord can respond and say, had you planted wheat, we would have been protected, then we're going to give him that claim, and the Chocher will have to pay because that's what's in the contract. You pay a fixed amount no matter what happens. Hishtadfu kostotav shel machkir. If all the properties of the landlord got hit, v'ishtodaf nami ha-behadayu, and this was just one amongst many of his fields that were wiped out, v'lo ishtodaf ruba debago, but the majority of the fields in the Bik'ah were not destroyed. My, what do we say now? Mi aminan kevin d'lo ishtodaf ruba debago, since the majority of fields in the area were not hit, lo manchile, he doesn't get a reduction in the fixed payment because there is no makat medina. O Dilma, kevin d'ishtodaf kulu arate, or maybe we'll say because all of the landlord's properties were hit, matzi amale, the chocher can say to him, Haimishum latach didach. That's because of your bad luck. It was your bad mazel. It's clear here that they're out to get you because it hit every one of your fields, even though the majority of the area was not hit. All of your fields were hit. So if all of your fields were hit, that's an indication that it's your problem. Where it says, Mistavra Damalei, he can say to him, Imishum latai didi, if it was for my bad luck that this happened, have a mishtarle purta, they would have left me some salvation, kidichtiv, like the Pasuk says in Yirmiyahu, kinishanu ma'at meharbe. We are a small remnant of many. The Pasuk and the context in which this is written is speaking about post-Khurban, the people in Eretz Yisrael, who are scared that Melech Bavel is going to come back and wipe them out, kill them as well, whatever he's left behind. So they come to Yirmiyahu and Avi, and it's an amazing story, only because of, you see from it, the psychology of people. They come to Yirmiyahu and Avi and say, what should we do? Because we don't know what's going to happen. Should we go down to Mitzrayim to try to escape the hand of Melech Bavel? Or should we remain here and take the risk that Melech Bavel might come back? So they say to Yirmiyahu and Avi, whatever Hashem says, we will do. Yirmiyahu goes, davens to Hashem, asks for what should be done. Hashem comes back and says, whoever stays here will be fine. Whoever goes down to Mitzrayim, that's Melech Bavel's next stop, and Mitzrayim is going to be wiped out. So Yirmiyahu brings back to the answer to these people, seemingly righteous individuals who had said, whatever God says, we will listen to. Yirmiyahu gives them the answer, stay here, don't go down to Mitzrayim. What do? They go down to Mitzrayim. So anyway, it's interesting psychology of people. They go down to Mitzrayim and they're wiped out because they didn't listen to the Navi. So in there, speaking to the Navi up front, it says, Ki nishanu mi'at miharbe. We are a remnant of the great Jewish nation and the peoples of this area. And the concept being that even when things are bad, Hashem always leaves some remnant or some residual. And that's his claim here. Even bad luck has its limits, or even bad news has its limits. There's always a little light of hope, a sparkle that you can hang on to. And so therefore, if he was really after me, he would have left me something. So that means it can't be my bad luck. It just must be a greater problem of the area. That's the claim of the landlord. And that's what the Gemara says he can make. And therefore, there's no reduction in the payment of the chocher. The third case. Nishtatfu kostotav shel chocher. All the fields of the sharecropper are wiped out. Vishtodaf ruba debagel. And the majority of the area was also wiped out. Vishtodaf nami haba adayu. And this field was amongst those many fields. My. What do we say here? Mi aminan came in the ishtodaf ruba debagel. Do we say because the majority of the area was wiped out, that's a makat medina? And manchile, therefore he gets a reduction in the fixed payment. Odilma. Kevin, the ishtodav kula arate. Maybe we say since all of the properties of the chocher were wiped out, matzi amrele mishum latach didach hu. It's your bad luck. Damishtadfu kostotecha. All your fields were hit by this problem. And therefore it's indicative of the fact that it's your bad luck that this came about because all of your fields were hit. Mistavra, da amrele mishum latach hu. Gemara says, it's your bad luck, and the landlord can say to him, you're the cause of the problem, therefore there's no reduction in the payment. Am I? Why would we say that? Hachanami neimale, imishum latai didi, who? Hava mishar le porta, dava mekayim bi, kinishanu me'at miharbe. Now, you would have suggested, why can't he say back the same answer that the machkir, the landlord, said back? The landlord said back before, if it was my bad luck, Hashem should have left me something. So why don't we say the same thing for the benefit of the chocher? So why doesn't he have the same claim that the landlord had, which was that when it's bad luck, Hashem leaves some remnant, some residual. So why can't he make that counterclaim to the landlord versus what we accepted as a valid claim of the landlord? Mishum d'amalei, because the landlord can say back, Iva chazit lishtiure lecha midei hamishtar lecha midenafshach. Because if Hashem was going to leave you over a remnant or a residual, he would have done it of your own properties, not on my properties. Meaning that it seems that this individual also has other properties, or that he has other possessions. And therefore, if Hashem is going to leave a remnant, leaving a remnant on the field that he's sharecropping on is just not the best place to have a remnant. The remnant would have been somewhere on his own property. So he says, as far as my properties are concerned, Your bad luck is the problem. And therefore, that's why you cannot take a reduction in the fixed payment. So here we have three different cases. Again, all the cases lean heavily in favor of the landlord and not in favor of the chocher, of the sharecropper, the fixed payer. And that's because the obligation of the fixed payer should be independent of what the field produces. And so the burden of proof is on him to show that this was a makat medina having nothing to do with him. If we can in any way associate the problem with him, then we will associate with him and say that you still have to make the fixed payment, and that was the result in each of these three instances. Meitave, now we have a question from Arachin. Haitash nat shidafon v'irakon, if it was a year in which there was wind, blasts of irakon and mildew, oshvi'it, or it was the Shemitah year, oshayu shanim kishnei Eliyahu, or there were years like the years of Eliyahu, which is drought, when Eliyahu is gozer, that there should be drought because the people are not behaving. So if any of those are true, eino ole lo min haminyan, none of those count. The Mishnah in Arachin is speaking about a case where a person sells a field during the Yovel. You sell a field during the Yovel, the field will return to its original owner at the Yovel. But there's also another mechanism of ge'ula, of redemption, which is that we take whatever the price is, and we divide it by the number of years that remain until the Yovel, and that gives you the yearly lease that he's paying, the lease fee that he's paying to keep the field. The owner has a right to come back and repatriate the property by paying him the residual amount of the lease. But the Torah demands that there is a minimum of 2 years that it stay in the hand of the buyer. Otherwise, nobody would ever buy anything because the risk would be so high that it'd be repatriated at any moment that there's no reason to buy something or lease something because it'd be taken away. So the Torah gives you a minimum of 2 years on the property. That minimum of 2 years, what the Mishnah is saying is, if it was one of these types of years, they don't count because these years are not productive years. They have to be productive years of the field, otherwise it doesn't count towards those 2 years. Tani, the writes there, Shidafon v'irakon, it places them in the same list as Dumya, the Shanim Kishnei Eliyahu. The years like the years of Eliyahu, which are complete drought. Mas Shnei Eliyahu Dulabi Tvuach Klau. In the years of Eliyahu, there's famine, which is there's a complete wipeout of anything because it's not raining at all. There's no rain, complete drought. There's no production of the fields whatsoever. So too, by Shidafon Riyokon, we're going to assume that there was no production whatsoever. If there is some production, even though it's subpar production, we would count it as a year. V'lo kamrinin makat midinai, and we don't say that it's some sort of makat midina. That means as long as somewhere in Israel there's some production going on, that's not called a makat midina. The only time you get a buy for that year, and it doesn't count towards your 2 years, is if there's a complete wipeout, if there's no production in the country whatsoever. Implying that if there was any production in the country, it would count towards your years. And why not say the same thing over here? If the individual can't plant the field or some natural disaster wiped out the field, if it wipes out all the fields around it, but if there is production around the area or in Israel, then that should count towards a year that is not a Shnat Shidafon. Gemara says, or the answer is, that the threshold or the determination is different in these cases. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak Shani Hotam. It's different over there by the case of the field that you are leasing until the Yovel. Damar Kra, the Pasuk says, Bimispar Shnei Tvuot Yimkar Lach, that by the years of production, it is sold to you. So Mispar Shnei Tvuot Shanim Sheish Behem Tvuah Ba'olam. All it says is it has to be years of Tvuah. So years of Tvuah means that there is Tvuah that is available in the world, meaning in the general market, that Tvuah is available. It has nothing to do with your personal field or your personal area. It has to do with the broader context because it's called a Shnei Tvuah. Is this a year of Tvuah? Or is this not a year of Tvuah? And that's the only question that needs to be answered. Is there produce available or is there not produce available? As long as there's produce available, then it has qualified or sufficiently qualified to be considered a Shnei Tvuah. And if that's the case, it'll count towards your 2 years. So the threshold here is much lower than the threshold by the case of the Chocher. Rashi limits it to Shumakom Ba'aretz. Rashi limits it to Eretz Yisrael. It's possible that the world has gotten smaller today, and therefore maybe the determination would not be just in Israel because of the ability to import and to bring grains from other places. Or maybe you could still argue that a Shnei Tvoa is determined by the country, and therefore Eretz Yisrael is the only thing that matters. So I think you could argue either way today, but Rashi clearly says it's connected to Eretz Yisrael. So Amalei Rav Ashi Rav Kano, Elomiato. Based on your understanding, Shvi'it Talelo Min HaMinyan. Shvi'it should work. Da'ika Tvoa B'chutz La'aretz. Because there is Tvoa that comes from Chutz La'aretz and supplies into Eretz Yisrael. So now, going back to your question about today, well, here it's talking about imports into Eretz Yisrael. But clearly there, when they're talking about Chutz La'aretz, they're talking about the areas or the areas on the perimeter of Eretz Yisrael that were adjacent to Eretz Yisrael that bring in Tvoa. They're not talking about Tvoa coming from far-flung places. So I still think that the question is valid, is how far does this extend today? But from the Gemara, it's open at least to the possibility that if the surrounding areas had Tvoa, that would work. Samalei, Shvi'it, Afkata Damalkohi. Shvi'it is a different story, because the Torah basically tells you that there is no Tvoa during that year. Not that there's no Tvoa in the market, but Afkata Damalka means that the king's decree is that there will be no planting, and there will be no Shanat Tvoa in this year. Hashem declares it as an off year. Whether there's Tvoa or not Tvoa has nothing to do with the determination of what the year is called. The year, according to this, is called a year without Tvoa in it, because a melech bitlo miluzora. God says you're not planting. Varehi kamo sheina. It's as if the year doesn't exist according to Hashem's decree. And therefore, Shemitah doesn't count, even though technically there is produce in the market. Amrale marzutra breder of mari dervina. Elmiata shvit lo telolo mina girua. If that's the case, how come Shvi'it counts towards the defeasance of a field which has been mukdash? Here we're speaking about a steachuzah. A steachuzah is a field that belongs to you through your inheritance. That means that the field always comes back to you in the Yovel. If you are mukdish such a field to Ekdesh, the Torah gives a fixed payment per year in order to redeem the field. It's based on 50 shekel for the field, but that is if you did it in the previous Yovel. That means that from this Yovel to the next Yovel, the total amount to redeem the field will be 50 shekel. That basically means it's 50 shekel over 49 years. So if I take 50 shekel and divide it into 49 years, I get 49 shekel and 48 pundion. So that turns out to be a shekel upundion de shana. It means one shekel and one pundion for each year. If I multiply that by 49, I get 49 shekel. If I take the pundion, I get 49 pundion. There's 48 pundion in a shekel. So that'll add up to the additional shekel. And I have one extra pundion, which the Gemara speaks about, that is used for the changing of the money or for the excess that's needed. But basically, it's a shekel pundion per year. So the question being proposed now is, why are you taking the 50 shekel and dividing it by 50? You should take the 50 shekel and divide it by 43. Because there are seven Shemitot that move through that period of time. And why are those counted towards the defeasance of that amount over the 49-year period? Alamatznan, the Mishnah says, Natein Sela Upundion Neshana. The Mishnah uses Sela instead of Shekel. The Sela in the Mishnah is equal to the Shekel of the Torah, because the Shekel of the Mishnah is half the size of the Shekel of the Torah. And two Shekel make up a Sela, and that's Shekel Kodesh is equal to the Sela. So there you have Selo Pundion Neshana. Amalei, Shani Hotam, the Chazia, the Mishtecha Behapere. Over there, the field has utility, which is that you can put the fruits out to dry in the field during those years. So in the Shemitah year, they are not Shnei Tvoa. They're not years of production. They're not years of produce. But the Shemitah year doesn't mean that you can't do anything with the land or with the ground. You may not plant, you may not harvest, but you could build buildings on the land, and you can also spread out your fruits from the previous year from the harvest and let them dry on the land. So the land has utility during that period. And we're talking about the payment to Ekdesh, we're talking about the years of utility between this Yovel and the next Yovel. The years of utility are 49. They may not all be planting utility, but there is utility to the land, If that's the case, then the 50 shekel is divided by the 49 years, and we don't accept the Shemitah from it. If you do not redeem it by the Yovel, then it belongs to the Kohanim. Once the Yovel comes in, by Yom Kippur on the Yovel, that property will then become the possession of Hekdesh and be distributed to the Kohanim, whose Mishmar is during that point in the Yovel. So the only way you can get it back is if you redeem it before the Yovel. So when you're Magdish it in the previous Yovel, it's 50 shekel over the next 49 years, because if you hit the 50th year, you'll no longer have the property. Amar Shmuel. Shmuel now qualifies our Mishnah and says, Lo shanu elish zara vitzamcha ve'achla chagav. The Mishnah only rings true if he planted the field, it grew, and then the locust came and destroyed it. Aval lo zara klal, if he didn't plant it at all, lo, then you do not get this exemption. Damarle, because he can say to him, Ilu zarato, had you planted the field, have mekayim be, this pasuk would come true, which is, lo yevoshu be'et ra'ah, ubimei ra'avon isbo. So over there in the Perek in Tehillim, David HaMelech is contrasting the evil people who do not rely on Hashem and all the bad things that they do, but those that are maminim b'Hashem and those that rely on Hashem. And one of the features of relying on Hashem and having emunah on Hashem is, lo yevoshu be'et ra'ah. They will not be embarrassed. They will not be shamed at times of evil. Ubemei ra'avon, and in times of famine, yisbo, they will still be satisfied. I mean that they won't suffer the fate of the evil ones, but rather they'll be spared by Hashem. So he says, listen, you didn't plant it. Yes, everything in the area got eaten by the locusts. There's not a single thing left. But I'm saying if you planted my field would have survived because I'm one of those maminim b'Hashem. And therefore, Hashem would have spared my field. Or at least, we could have tested it and seen. But the fact that you didn't plant means we didn't test it, so we don't know, and therefore you're not going to get a reduction because of that. Meitiv Rav Sheshet. Rav Sheshet says, do we rely on these types of miracles? Ro'eh, sheyo ro'eh. You have a shepherd that is shepherding his herd. V'niyeh chedro. And he leaves the herd out in the fields. U'baliyir. Comes back into the city, taking a dinner break. Ubaze vitaraf, a wolf comes and takes from the herd, eats of the herd, ubari vitaras, or a lion comes and eats. Again, the verbs used here, taraf versus daras, has to do with the nature of how they kill and how they eat their prey. Ein omrim, we do not say, ilu ayasham hayam matzil. We don't say, well, if the shepherd was there, he could have saved them. El omdim oto, we assess, im yachol atzil chayav. If this person is capable of saving the animals, or the situation warranted that he could have saved them, chayav, then he's responsible. V'im lav, patur. And if not, he is patur. I mean, if it wasn't feasible for him to save these animals, despite the fact that he wasn't there, we're not going to make him chayav, because even if he was there, it would have made no difference. V'amai, why don't we make the same claim that Shmuel is making over here? Neimele, ihavai tatam, havamekayim b'cha. If you were there, then Hashem would have performed a miracle and said, Gametari, Gamadov, Hika Avdecha. So David HaMelech, when he is boasting to Shaul as to why he is worthy of going out to fight Goliath, he says, you know, I'm a courageous young man. Because when the animals came to attack the flocks that I was shepherding, Gametari, also the lion, Gamadov, also the bears, Hika Avdecha. I smote them, meaning that I kept them away from the flocks, I killed them, and so I'm a serious warrior over here. But that means that David HaMelech, a little kid, was able to save the flocks from animals. Obviously, it was that Hashem was watching over him. So the individual says to this guy, yes, you may not have been able to save the animals, but maybe if you were there, Hashem would have performed that miracle, the same ones that he performed for David HaMelech. Mishum Damarle. Because he can say back to him, Ivavit chazit li ruchushe l'chanisa, havit rachis l'chanisa, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. If the miracles are going to happen already, which this would have been a miracle, that I would have been able to save the herds, then Hashem will do a real miracle. A real miracle, like Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Tamachin ize dube bekarnayu. This is a story in Masechet Tanit, in a series of stories from Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, who is a man that performs miracles, has miracles performed about him all the time. One of those miracles is in the days of Rechini Mendoza, the goats came back with the bears in their horns. They were able to defeat the bears or defeat the enemies. And so too, he says, listen, what do you need me to be there for the miracles? You want a miracle to happen? Can have a miracle happen like Rabbi Chanina Mendoza. V'neimale. Why doesn't the owner of the herd say back to him, Nehi delenisa rabo lohava chazina, I wasn't worthy of a big miracle. Venisa zuta chazina, but maybe I was worthy of a small miracle. Meaning that if you were there, maybe Hashem would have saved them. But for the animals to come with the bears in their horns, that's a little bit excessive. I'm not up on that level. The Gemara says, Kasha, that is a question or unresolved issue. Generally, the difference between Teiku and Akasha is that Akasha has an answer that is very difficult or could be answered. A Teiku is something that is unresolved completely. Despite the Kasha over here, the Halacha follows this position of Shmuel, which is that if you don't plant at all, there is a claim against you that had you planted, maybe there would have been some salvation through a small miracle. Now, that is a difficult position, as the Balei HaTosafot point out, because he says, Tema, my kasha, why is this a question? Amram Nael, the Chamarle Zarachitim Vizarasare, in the case that we started today's daf with, where he told him to plant wheat, and instead he planted barley, Vishtodof, the Matsi Amarle, he can say to him, we said that the landlord can say to him, had you planted the right thing, my tefillot would have been answered. So then, if he doesn't plant at all, it's a kosher cane. How do you know that it was roi l'ishtadef? If he can say, if you planted a different crop, I would have been saved, then certainly he says, if you didn't plant at all, had he planted, maybe I could have been saved. Why is that not a valid claim? Shmuel's case is different. Kugon shamar le zra koma shetirtze. Plant whatever you want. Da'ashta lo matzi le'meimar. Now he can't say my tefillot would have helped because his tefillot weren't directed at a particular item but a generic tefillah. So we see his tefillot didn't help because he gave him a carte blanche to plant whatever he wants. So now we see that that's not a valid claim. So now we have to mistama lo ava mekabel kosh brochot tefillotosho zeh shiatzliya koma shizra imushle selones. So therefore, we have to move from tefillah to nes. So that which he said before about the tefillot is no longer valid, because if he was going to be covered, he would have been covered already by the tefillah. The fact that he wasn't covered by the tefillah now brings us into a world of nes, because his tefillah was a generic tefillah, and he can't make the claim that you switched it, and therefore you caused the problem, didn't allow my tefillot to be accepted. The additional thing is, the Tosafot says, Tema, Amaylo Parich Mimatnitan de Poalim. Why don't we ask from the Mishnah in Poalim, the Tnan? Ariva Dov, Arez Onis. If you have a lion or a bear, it's an Onis. Vamai, Neima Ilu Nilcham Behem, Havimakayim Be Gamet Ari. Why don't we say over there the same thing, which is, had you stood up to them, the miracle would have saved you. V'yesh Lamar, Dehotam, Kevin Shayasham, that since he was there, Velo balo ruach gvura, and he didn't have that courageous feeling while he was out there with the flock. En yukolomar davi mekayim be. Then you can't make the claim that Hashem would have protected him in this miraculous way. Avahalkosh lo yasham, but over here where he wasn't present, dilma avi avahotam avabaruach gvura. Maybe if he actually was there, he would have had that courageous feeling, and he would have datli lachem, and he would have gone out to fight them. Avi mekayim be gametari. So it's an interesting, if he's there, you can't make the claim that he should have acted because he might have had the miraculous salvation. The fact that he didn't get that feeling that it was coming to him and this was the right time, that's already a sign that the miracle is not going to happen. Because part of the miracle is the fact that Hashem gives you the idea to go and fight. And then when you fight, you are successful and the miracle happens. So if you're present, you can't make the claim that, why don't you fight them? There would have been some miracle. But if you're not present at all, then you can make the claim. Had you been present, you might have had that feeling. You might have had that courageousness bubbling up inside of you, and you would have run to fight them, and you would have had the miraculous salvation. So Tosfot over here is trying to narrow and define when you can make these claims for miracles. Again, here he narrowed the scope and said it's only in a case where you weren't there at all can you make that claim. If you're there and it didn't happen, or you didn't act, then you can't make a claim for a miracle. The other thing is, you can't say that your tefillot would have helped unless it deals with a particular item and not dealing in a generic sense. All right, now the Gemara continues and says, Tani Chado, one brayta says, Pam Rishona Ushnia Zor'a, that he plants it once and twice, and then Shlishit Enu Zor'a, and the third time he doesn't plant it. Yitani Idach, and an alternate brayta says, Shlishit Zor'a, he does plant the third time, Revi'it Enu Zor'a, the fourth time he does not plant it. Now, if you look in Rashi, Rashi says, Pam Rishona Vishnia, Zarav Achla Chagav O Nishtafa, that he planted it, and then the locust ate it, or it was blown by the wind. Choser v'zora, shenit. He goes and plants it again. V'meno zora, if he doesn't go and plant it again, enu menachelo, then he doesn't deduct from him, afiluhi makat medina, even if there is a general hit to the whole population and the whole area. Now, you could read this in one of two ways. You could read this as being in sequential years. So say he planted it the first year, and then the locust came. Planted it the second year, the locust came. And then the third year, he doesn't have to plant it, or the fourth year, depending on what the situation is. That seems a less likely explanation, even though it reads better into the Braita. First of all, because of the upcoming Gemara, as well as each year should be an independent decision. Just because there was locust last year doesn't mean there's going to be locust this year. So the more likely explanation is that we're talking about in a single year. In that single year, if you plant and it's destroyed, you have to continue planting. You have to keep trying to get something to grow. Say you planted and in the early stages, it was wrecked. And then again, you plant again. How many times do you have to keep trying? So that's what we're discussing here. In a single year, how many times do you have to keep trying? So then the Brayta will give you two options. Try three times and give up the fourth, or try two times and give up the third. How do we reconcile between these brayot? My answer is halakasha haruka Rabbi haka Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That is like Rabbi, and that is like his father, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. It's a machloket found all over Shas. We saw it in Baba Kama with regards to a shor muad. How many times does a shor muad have to gore in order to become a shor muad? We discussed it over there. Discussed it in Yevamot with regards to a black widow, a woman who has been married a number of times and her husbands die each time. How many times do her husbands have to pass away before she is considered a black widow? So that's a machloka between Rabbi and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Haka Rabbi Damrei Trezim Ne'avi Chazoka. Rabbi says two times is a chazoka, and therefore the third time you don't have to do anything anymore. You've already established the trend after two times. Haka Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Damar Bitzlat Zimnei Havei Chazoka, who says that you need three to establish a trend, and therefore until it happens three times, you cannot establish the trend. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel will be the author of the Braita that says, try three times, and the fourth you do not have to. And Rabbi will be the author of the Braita that says, try two times, and then the third time you will not have to try. Amar Reish Lakish. Now, in context, connecting it to Reish Lakish, that supports the reading of this previous Gemara as we're referencing to a single year, rather than to multiple years. Rashi says the Braita are referring to cases when you plant it and then it was eaten by the locust, or cases where it was planted and it just didn't grow at all. On the other hand, the Ramban and other Rishonim disagree and say that the Braita are only speaking about cases where you planted it, it did not grow, not in cases where the locust ate it. They are partly influenced by the upcoming statement of Reish Lakish. Rashi reads Reish Lakish's qualification as a qualification of the Braitot themselves. On the other hand, other Rishonim see the qualification of Reish Lakish referencing to the Mishnah and not to the Braitot. And you can see that in the Rosh, he quotes from the Rif, who does not quote the Braitot, but yet quotes Reish Lakish. So he must believe that Reish Lakish is modifying the Mishnah. On the other hand, Rashi, who thinks that the Braitot include the case of Chagav, thinks that Reish Lakish is modifying the Braitot. I'm Reish Lakish. Lo shanu elish zora vitzamcha v'achla chagav. It's only true if he plants it, it grew, and then the locust ate it. Aval zara v'lo tzamcha, if he planted it, it never emerged, it never grew. Matzamrele balakarka kol yamei zera zara la v'azil. He can say back to him, as long as it is the planting season, You got to keep planting. I mean, you got to keep trying. It's one thing if you planted and the land was successful at bringing forth the produce and then it got destroyed. If that happens a number of times, then we say, okay, give up. But over here where nothing has grown, then we say you got to keep trying to get something to come out of the ground. And it doesn't matter how many times. As long as it's still the planting season, you're obligated to keep planting, so then there's a possibility of it emerging. It's not an exogenous variable that's coming in each time and destroying it. It's simply that you must have planted wrong, you must have done something wrong, you got the wrong timing. There's something wrong that's causing it not to emerge, you gotta keep trying. Vad emat. How long does this span? So Amara Papa, ad da'atu arise midabra, v'kaima kima areshayu. It's when the arisim, the sharecroppers, are coming back in from the fields, and kima is above their heads. So now, this is where the astronomy comes in. Quick astronomical lesson here. And we're going to use the view of Chazal as well as the Rishonim, even though today we know that speaking in these terms is incorrect, but the truth is that what they are saying is true, but for a different reason. And that is that over the year, if a person looks up into the night sky, they will see different star constellations in the night sky. And as you move through the year, those constellations change which constellations are there during the night and how they move through the sky at night. The way Chazal and the Rishonim viewed it, it's called Galgal Chozer. The earth was stationary and they, well, called the kippah, or there was some sort of globe around it, and the stars were affixed to it, and that moved. And so since that was moving, things, the stars rose and set, or certain stars are visible at certain times of the year. We know that it's really not a product of the stars moving, but rather that Earth is revolving around the sun, and therefore you're in different positions of the sky during different times of the year, and therefore you're looking at different angles or views of the sky during different parts of the year. But effectively, it has the same result, which is that what you're seeing in the sky is moving and is different during the years. The 12 signs of the zodiac are a result of this. The zodiac is made up of bodies of stars that show up or look like certain images or animals. You're familiar with many of them, the ones that we're going to discuss today, just so that you're familiar with them is, we know that the Siman for Adar is a fish, or Pisces is the sign during of the zodiac during Adar. Nisan, the sign of the zodiac then is a Teleh, which is Aries. And the sign for Iyar is an ox, or is otherwise known as Taurus. The zodiac is made up of these 12 different signs, which are really constellations of stars that shape or look like these animals or these items. Now what happens is that as you move through the year, different signs of the zodiac are going to be visible because of where we are located in terms of our revolution around the sun, according to the way that Chazal and Rashi are speaking about it, because of the rotation of the kippah or the galgal, which is moving the stars around. And the way that it works is that each zodiac gets 2-hour windows to be what's called sholeit and move through the sky. That means, for instance, at night, over the night period, over the day period, you have 12 hours. So at 12 hours of nighttime, 6 of the zodiac signs will be visible. That starting at the beginning of the night, first zodiac sign will move into the visible range, and then it will be there for 2 hours, and then shift and shift and shift and shift, until 12 hours later, that zodiac sign sets. The same is true during the day, it just happens to be it's not visible during the day, because the sun overwhelms the zodiac. Which sign of the zodiac is considered to be that month has to do with which sign of the zodiac rises with the sun and sets with the sun. That means in the month of Adar, the zodiac sign of the fish is rising at the time of the sun and then sets at the time of the sun, which means that the sign of Adar will not be visible whatsoever during Adar because it will always be there during the daytime and not at night. And that's why that is the sign of that month, which is Pisces will not be visible during the month of Adar. And if you move on then to the month of Nisan, then Aries will not be visible during the month of Nisan. That's the time that it's Sholeit. What means to have Shlita or be Sholeit means that you spend the entire day with the sun out, ruling or running the world. And that's why that sign is the sign of the particular month. So this happens, again, with 12 signs and a rotation of these 12 signs. All right, so now Kima is Pleiades, which is a constellation of stars. Rashi over here claims that it is the Zanavatzle, which means the tail of Aries. As the Balei HaTosafot point out, that's not true. It's a little off. It's not the tail of Aries. It's actually found in Taurus. It's in the hind quarters of Taurus. That's really where it is. He says it got mixed up by the Gemara in Brachot, but it's close enough. I mean that they're not far apart, but it is not exactly the Zanav Hatzle. So that's the first thing you have to know, that we're talking about Kima. So now Kima is going to be at the quote-unquote tail end of Aries. So that means that in the month of Nisan, Aries is there through the whole day. That means that when the sun rises, Aries is there. When the sun sets, Aries is also setting at that point in time. It will not be visible. In the previous month, Aries would have risen 2 hours earlier, or Aries would have been visible at the tail end of the night. Or, if you go 2 months back, Aries would be visible at the last 4 hours of the night, because it rises 2 hours earlier each month that you go back. There are two problems with this. One is what you mentioned, which is that the days are not of equal duration. So let's say it's Sha'ot Zmaniyot. That's how we'll deal with that. The other problem is that it's really connected, as the Balei HaTosafot say, to the secular or the solar calendar, and not to the lunar calendar. So even though we're speaking about months of the lunar calendar, Tosafot goes on to say it's not the Shvat of the Levana, but Shvat of the Shemesh. He recognizes that the months of the solar calendar are important here and not necessarily the months of the lunar calendar. All right, so now we want to know where the tail of Aries is at a particular time. That particular time, or Kima, is when the workers are coming in from the field. Rashi claims that the Chocharim here, the Kavanim, the Arisim, come in from the field at the 9th or 10th hour of the day. That's when they return home. So basically, we want to know, when is the tail of Aries at mid-sky, the meridian, when the workers are coming back from work, meaning at 9 or 10 hours on the day. So we want to know, when is Aries found just past the midday point? So its tail, or where Kima is found at the meridian, overhead, directly overhead. So now we know that Aries rises with the sun in Nisan. That means that 6 hours into the day, it would be at the meridian. 2 hours later, its tail would be at the meridian. So that means that 8 hours into the day, during the month of Nisan, the tail of Aries would be at the meridian point. So if I step back 1 month, then it would be that the tail of Aries was at midpoint, not at the 8th hour, but at the 10th hour of the day. And so what Rashi describes over here is that in Adar, the mazal of Dagim, of Pisces, is the mazal. And therefore, in the morning, Pisces rises. After 2 hours into that day, Aries rises. So then, Aries will move. Subsequent to that, when Pisces reaches the 8th hour of the day, Aries will be at the midpoint of the sky. And when the Pisces reaches the 10th hour of the day, Aries will be just past the meridian, and its tail will be at the midline of the sky. Rashi claims, that's what's being spoken about here, that until Adar, that is when the planting season is available. From the rainy season beginning in Tishrei Cheshvan, all the way until Adar is considered to be the planting season. Tosafot disagrees, again, for two reasons. One of the reasons is that the tail of Aries is not exactly right. It's really the back or the hind of Taurus, which is backwards. Taurus faces the opposite direction in the sky. It's close, but not exact. Secondly, he says that we know that the workers don't come back at 10 hours on the day. We learned in Asocher et HaPoalim that the workers' day begins at Alot HaShachar and ends at Seita Kochavim. The question of whether it belongs to them or the Balabait, the difference between Shkia and Seita Kochavim or the Alot HaShachar. But he says they don't come home from work until Seita Kochavim. So we're talking about a case where the tail of Aries is at mid-meridian when the sun sets, or at the end of the day, when the day is up. So that means that Tosafot thinks that it's happening 2 hours later, but it's at mid-sky. So he has to move back a month. If he moves it back into Shvat, that will be the case. When will Aries' tail be at meridian? That is in the month of Shvat. Because there, again, it's rising behind not only Pisces, but it's also rising behind its Dali or Aquarius that is rising then. So at that point, you have the Dali rising. Behind it is the Dog rising it. Behind it is Aries. So that means that Aries only rises after we are 4 hours into the day. And that means when you reach the tail end of the day, the tail of Aries will be at the mid-meridian point. And therefore, Tosafot thinks that it's the month of Shvat. There is a view on the Rishonim that connects it to the midpoint of the winter. That's when Kima, the Gemara in Brachot, talks about two different constellations. One constellation that's in the winter time or connected to winter, which is Kima, and the other one, which is Seal, that is connected to the summertime. So he says, what does it mean that Kima is mid-overhead? That means at the midpoint of the winter. So the midpoint of the winter would be around, if you're using the solar calendar, roughly around February 6th would be the midpoint of the winter. So that's another possibility as to what the number is. Okay, that's an astronomical lesson for today. And that's what the Gemara is telling you. That is the planting season. The only problem we have with that is Meitveh. Shmuel Goel Mishum Rabbi Meir Omer, V'chein Rabbi Shimon Ben Asi Omer, Kidvarav. Everybody says this. They are trying to deal with the pasuk that is found at the end of the Mabul when Hashem speaks to Noach. And he says to Noach that after the Mabul, I no longer will stop the seasons and the cycles of the year from happening. And he says, Old kol yimei haaretz, zera, v'katzir, kor, v'chom, v'kayitz, v'choref, v'yom v'layla lo yishbotu. So yom v'layla is not involved here because that's day and night. That's talking about the day cycle. But the seasonal cycles, the Torah gives you six seasons, each one offsetting each other. Zera is planting, katzir is harvesting. They are the opposite ends of the year. They have kor, v'chom, the cold and the hot. Kayitz, v'choref. So now, those are six periods of time. How are those six periods of time divided up over the year? Here is what's being brought in the Braita. Chatzi Tishrei, halfway through Tishrei, Mar Cheshvan, the whole month of Cheshvan, v'chatzi Kislev, Zera. That is the planting season. Chatzi Kislev, half of Kislev, Tevet, the whole Tevet, v'chatzi Shvat, Choref. That is the Choref. Rashi says the word Choref comes from the word Chorfo, Charif. It is the point in time when the winter is in its strength. So winter will be over in Tu B'Shvat. That does not mean that the cold will be over then. Because that is Chatzi Shvat, Adar V'Chatzi Nisan, Kor. That is the cold season. The Gemara has a statement in other places, Shili de Kaito. The tail end of the summer is the hot part. So even though the Kayitz is over, the Chom comes after that. And same thing with the cold. Even though the winter is over, the cold is tailing the winter. Chatzi Nisan, Iyar, half of Nisan, the whole month of Iyar, v'chatzi Sivan, Katzir. That's the harvest time. That's why we're bringing the Omer. That's why you're bringing the Shtei Alechem. That's for the barley harvest, the wheat harvest. Chatzi Sivan, Tammuz, half of Sivan, the whole month of Tammuz and Chatzi Av, Kayitz. It's called Kayitz because they put the Ktziot out in the field to dry. They cut the fruits and put them out to dry. That's why it's called the Kayitz. Chatzi Av, Elul, v'chatzi Tishrei, Chom. That is the hot season, which is, again, I said, Shulei Kaita, the end of the summer, is the hot season. And again, if you look at these, they're also 6 months apart. That the Zera and the Katzir, all of them are 6 months apart. Rabbi Yehuda Monemi Tishrei. Rabbi Yehuda says, don't do this half-month offset. It starts, it's two-month period, starting with Tishrei. So Tishrei Cheshvan. Then it's Kislev Tevet, and you do the same cycle through. Rabbi Shimon Monemi Mar Cheshvan. Bishima just skews 15 days the other way. So he says, don't start from the 15th of Tishrei, start from the 1st of Cheshvan. That means that the person here with the latest planting area or season is Rabbi Shimon. So he says, Man Mekil Bekulu. Who is the most Mekil here? Meaning, who allows for a sharecropper or a chocher Phil's obligation to plant, meaning that he plants in the time period that it's planting? Rabbi Shimon is the most makil because he allows you to plant until the latest time period. Which is if you take 2 months from the beginning of Cheshvan, he thinks that the planting season is Cheshvan and Kislev, so he is till the beginning of Tevet. So Rabbi Shimon is the most makil. Bekulei hai lo kamar. He doesn't say going beyond that. According to Rashi, you're going all the way to Adar. According to the Balei Tosafot, you're going into Shvat. But Rabbi Shimon says, until Tevet, that's the end of the planting season. So where are you getting this longer period of time? Gemara says, lo hakasha, had the kabbalim imnei becharfe, had the kabbalim imnei beafle. Depends what type of crop that he is taking from him. The chorfe, again, it comes from choref, but it means the early crop. The afle is, the afelot are the late crops. So it depends. There are early crops that need to be planted, like Rabbi Shimon says, by Tevet. There are later crops that can be planted all the way through Shvat, or maybe according to Rashi, into Adar. Now Rashi defines over here what those are. Bechorfei, what are the early crops? Chitin v'shifon, wheat and rye, hanizreim b'tkilat ha'chorf, they're planted beginning of the winter. Bafle, what are the late crops? Se'orim v'kitniot, it is barley and legumes and hanizreim b'adar. The problem is, if you look in the psukim in the end of Parshat Vayera, when it's speaking about the barad, it says which crops are destroyed by the barad and which crops are not destroyed by the barad. The crops that are destroyed by the barad are the ones that are early and their stalks are already hardened, and therefore they get destroyed. The psukim in Vayera say, "Vapishta vahagivol nukata." So the pishta and the givol were hit. Ki aseora aviv, because the barley is an early crop. Va'pishta givol, and the pishta is already in its stalk. Ve'achita va'kusemet, the wheat and the spelt, lo nuku, were not hit, ki afiloteinu, they're the late crop. It's the exact opposite of what Rashi says over here. Rashi over here says that the chitin are the early crop and the sora the late crop. The psukim tell us just the opposite, that the sora is the early crop and the chitin are late crop. It's also evidenced by the korbanot that we bring. The korban of the sora is the korban haomer that is brought on Pesach. The korban from the chita is brought on Shavuot, which is the shtei alechem. So it's clear that the barley harvest precedes that of the wheat harvest. The only thing you could argue in favor of Rashi is that, yes, in terms of harvest, the early harvest is the sora, the late harvest is the wheat. Rashi is talking about the planting, that the wheat needs to be planted earlier. It means more of a dormant state or a longer duration in the field. And the sora is planted later. That's the only thing you could say in defense of Rashi. Otherwise, it's the opposite of what the psukim say in terms of the timing of when is each planted. So the answer to the question then is, are we talking about the early planting or the late planting? Rabbi Shimon and the other Tanaim are talking about the early planting. The threshold that we gave was for the late planting. And so it depends on the agreement between the parties as to whether you're governed by the early planting window or by the later window. All right, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, im kabla yimenu b'maot. Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah says that if the fixed fee is paid in cash and not out of produce, then you don't get any deduction for ruinous years or when there are problems with the field. Ha'u gavra, the kabel ara the mizra, behu tume. He had accepted as a sharecropper to plant the field with garlic. Aguda de namara malka, sabo. It was on the banks of the river Malkazaba. Bizuze, he was going to pay a fixed cash amount, a fixed rental fee per year. Stakar nar Malkazaba. The river was dammed or got clogged up. It seems from Rashi that it was intentionally dammed. They wanted to divert the water for the fields upriver. But by doing that, the river now dried up downriver. And now there's no water for the garlic. As Rashi notes over here, these are a wet climate crop, which means that it needs to be water there all the time. There needs to be moisture in the soil all the time. So he was dependent on the river flowing in order to plant the garlic. So it's now that the river's gone, he can't plant the garlic or the garlic's not going to succeed. Ata the kemi de rabo, came before Rabba Amarlei, nar malka saba lo avid de mischar. He says that that's not normal for the river to dry up or to be diverted. It seems like the river flow was not high enough, and therefore when they diverted the water up river, it didn't allow for any more flow down river. If there was sufficient flow in the river, then even if they diverted the river up river, it still would have flowed down river and it would have been fine. So he says it's an unforeseen circumstance, but it's also a makat midinahi. It has nothing to do with this person in particular. It has to do with anybody along that river is going to be hurt by the fact that the river is no longer flowing. So zil nochile. Go and take a reduction on the fixed fee that you're paying. That's a makat midina, which our Mishnah says you're entitled to a reduction in the fee for the chakirut. Amrulei rabbanon the rova. The rabbanon said, rova, anan snan. What about our Mishnah? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, im kiblai menu b'maot. We accepted it for money. Ben kachu ben kach ein menachelo min chakuro. He's paying a fixed fee based on a cash payment. Then there's no reduction in the payment. Amalo late to chashla the Rabbi Yehuda. Nobody worries about Rabbi Yehuda, meaning that Rabbi Yehuda's shita is not accepted la'alacha, because his idea is not completely right. In that even if you're paying with cash, the assumption for someone who's working the field is that they're paying out of the produce of the field, but they're just going to monetize it and then give you the money. Even though they're technically paying you in cash, that doesn't mean that they're not relying on the production of the field to generate that cash to pay you. And so if the production of the field isn't there, then the cash payment is also at risk because it still relies in some way on the production of the field, similar to the Chakirut, which promised you a fixed amount of produce from the field on a given year. So to there, if there's a Makat Medina, the person's going to be impaired in his ability to pay you, and therefore we need to reduce the lease payment or the rental payment that he's paying per year. Right now, next Mishnah. Hamikabel sadeh mechavero ba'asara kur chuitim l'shana. Person accepted the field to work it. This as a sharecropper, and he was going to pay 10 kur chitim per year. Velakta. And then the produce on that field got hit. Just means that it was lower quality. Doesn't mean it disappeared, it didn't grow, it's just low quality. Notein lo mitocha. He pays out of the field. Hayu chita yafot. If the wheat was super good during that year, the quality was in excess of its normal quality, lo yomar lo, you shouldn't say to him, areni lokeach min ashuk, I'm going to pay you the 10 kor chitim from the marketplace because I want to keep the better quality stuff. So I'm going to pay you out of the marketplace. Elenotein lo mitocha. You get paid out of the field. So what the Mishnah says is, even though a chocher is paying a fixed fee, which is 10 kor of chitim, and he has to pay that no matter what the production of the field is, even if the production of the field doesn't meet that, he's got to pay. Nevertheless, the payment still comes out of the produce of the field. That means for the good or for the bad. If it's worse quality, you still get paid it. Better quality, you get paid it. And this is this idea that even the chocher, who's paying a fixed fee, is still relying on the production of the particular field for his payments. And so therefore over here, he gets paid out of the field for better or for worse. V'zu b'chakirut utzrecha l'shnota. Rashi says, based on the principle before, that this only has application by chakirut, but not by kablanut, but not by an aris. Because by kablanut, it is pshita. It's straightforward. The cholchad zochem mitchayev b'chalko. Every person gets exactly what his share is. So it doesn't matter what the quality is. They're going to share in the better or the worse quality, whatever comes to you. The chiddush is by chakirut. Even though it's a fixed payment, the fixed payment is still relying on the production or the yield of the field. And so therefore, whatever the yield or quality is of the field, that's what you're going to get as your payment for the chakirut. Hal gavra, the kabal ara, basafsata. He accepted the field to plant it for hay. Bikurei disare. But he's going to pay in barley. So he took the field to plant and get hay out of the field, but he still leased the field based on barley payments. Avda asafstata. It was successful at producing the hay. The hay can be harvested very early in the season. And then, v'charsha v'zara sare. There was sufficient time after the hay had emerged and he had harvested that. There was sufficient time for him to replant and put barley in the ground. V'laku, hane sare. But then the se'orim did not grow well. It was not successful at all. Shacha Rav Chaviva Misura, the Parat, the Kameh Darvina. So Rav Chaviva Misura, or Rabbi Chanina Misura, sent this question to Ravina. Ki haye gavna mai. What do we do in this situation? Ki lakta notein lo mitocha dami. When it was problematic, it's the equivalent of paying out of the field itself, because he promised him barley, and this is the barley of the field, so he's going to get whatever came out of the field, the barley of the field. Oh, lo, or maybe not, because he was only supposed to plant hay in the field. That's what he took the field for, and the field successfully gave him the hay. Amalei mi domi. How can you compare this to our Mishnah? Hatam lo avda ara shlichuta demoro. Over there, the land didn't do what it was supposed to do. So then you could talk about, first of all, paying him with the lower quality stuff that came out of the field, Or if it failed completely, you can talk about a possibility of a makat medina and a reduction in price. But that's because the field didn't produce what you would expect the field to produce, which is average quality grain. So in that case, you have a claim. Hacha avda ara shlichuta demara. Over here, the field did what it was supposed to do. He was given the field to plant hay, and it produced hay. Now, he was supposed to pay him se'orim. The way that the transaction is structured is that you use the field for hay, and you pay me barley. The underlying assumption is that he's going to get the barley from the marketplace because he's not planting barley. The payment is independent of the actual production of the field. Given that, when he tried to plant the barley to save himself the trouble of having to go out to the shuk or the cost of going out to the shuk, that was something that was not necessarily agreed upon or something that the recipient, the landlord, has to accept because he accepted barley, but he accepted full-fledged, good-quality barley because he didn't assume the guy would plant it with barley. And so therefore, you have no claim over here. The land did what it was supposed to. You got what you were supposed to get out of the field, which is the hay. The failure of the barley is not the problem with the field or the landlord, and therefore you as a chocher have to pay him regular quality barley. That would also be true as if conversely it was very high quality barley, the owner of the land would not have a lien on that. He could go to the shuk and pay him regular type of barley. How gavra, the kabul pardes michavrei, person accepted a vineyard from his friend, be'eser dani chamra, for 10 barrels of wine. So instead of getting paid out of the production, which would have been the grapes, he gets paid out of the final product, which is the wine. So he says to him he's going to get 10 barrels of wine in the back end for allowing him to work this kerem, this vineyard. Takif ha'uchamra. That wine turned into vinegar, it fermented, and it was no longer the good quality or the 10 barrels of wine that he was supposed to provide for him. Sabar v'ana l'meimar, hainu matzniten. Sounds like our Mishnah. Lakta, notein lo mitocha. If it's bad stuff, you give him what the bad stuff is. So do it here. This wine is the product of this vineyard, so that you get whatever the product of the vineyard is. That's what the chakirut works as, that you get from this field. Amalei Ravashi, midomi. How can you compare the cases? Hotam lo avda arash lichuta. Over there in our Mishnah, the land produced something that was subpar quality. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. Hocha avda arash lichuta. Over here, the land produced great grapes. It produced full-fledged good grapes. And then the fermentation or the wine process is left up to the mazel of the particular individual. This is a view of the Gemara in general, that the fermentation or the success of the wine has to do with the mazel of the particular individual. And so the fact that the wine fermented and turned into vinegar is the bad mazel of the chocher, of the person working the field, and therefore it's his problem. He promised 10 barrels of wine. He's got to show up with 10 barrels of wine. And it doesn't necessarily mean 10 barrels of wine from this field, because the land did what it was supposed to do, which is produce grapes, and good quality grapes. Now, Moder Ravashi be'inve de kadum, u'besadeh shelakta be'omreha. Ravashi agrees, if there is a problem with the field itself, then you can argue that you get paid out of mitocha, because then the field didn't do what it's supposed to do. So if you get grapes that Rashi calls that are rotten or that have worms in them, so even though technically it's not that grapes on the vine, but the grapes themselves never made it to the point where they could be pressed properly, that's already a problem of the field, which is the field produced subpar grapes. And then you could say to the person, you get what you get, because the field didn't do what it was supposed to do, which is produce good quality grapes. And the same is true with Omrea, that if you put out the bundles to dry in the field, and then while they're out in the field, something happens, they rot, or something goes bad, so even though they're out of the ground already, that's still considered to be a part of the job of the land. The job of the land is to produce the product, and then when you put the product on there to dry it out, the land is part and parcel of the drying out of the product on the land. So if while it's drying out on the land, something goes wrong, that's also a part of the quote-unquote production of the land. And you can say to the Baal Bayit, Magia Lecha, whatever it is, you get, and you can't demand a higher quality product. This is what your field produced. This is what you're going to get. So Ravashi agrees, when it's the product itself from the field that is problematic, then you can give that to the Baal Bayit and say, this is what you get. On the other hand, if it's post the field's production, then it becomes the problem of the chocher. And in cases where you weren't supposed to plant that, or wasn't necessarily agreed that you would plant that, again, you don't have any rights in that case. Okay, next Mishnah. Amikabel sadeh mechavero lezara asurim. He received a field to plant it with barley. Lo yizrena chitim. He may not plant it with wheat. Chitim, but if he got it for wheat, yizrena seorim. He does have permission to plant barley. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel oser. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, no. Tvua, if he received it to plant grain, lo yizrena kitnit. He should not plant it with legumes. Kidnit, if he has it for legumes, Yizrena tfua. He does have a right to plant it with grains. Shimon Gamliel oser. In both these cases, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is oser. The Gra notes here that the Rambam and the Rif have an opposite girsa here with regards to tfua and kidnit. There are two things to discuss over here. First, about whom is this said? Rashi claims that this is to do with a chocher, because the chocher has a fixed payment, and therefore he could disconnect the fixed payment from whatever is growing in the field. Mish is telling him, but if you agreed to grow this, you have to grow that item, because we're going to see in a second its impact on the field itself, which it drains the field. It drains the nutrients of the field. So in an instance where the chitin machishot karka yoter min ha-seorim, wheat takes more out of the field than barley. So if you agreed for wheat, then you can plant wheat or you can plant barley. But if you agreed for barley, you can only plant barley and not wheat, because that would be taking a crop that drains the field in a greater way. So here, Rashi claims it's only true by a chocher, and the reason behind this has to do with the amount that these items draw from the field. So what you can do is you can downgrade, but you cannot upgrade. So you can downgrade to something that takes up less of the nutrients, but you can't upgrade to something that takes more of the nutrients. And the same is true with regards to the kitnit and the tvua. So now, Rashi says, de'ibe kablanut, if he's an aris, ha'amrinan, tichush ara, v'lo tichush mara. We say we'd rather give up the quality of the field and not have to lose out. Rashi says that if he upgrades the crop from barley to wheat, even though it draws down harder on the land, it still produces something that the Balabayit will be a beneficiary of, because he's going to get a percentage of that. By the chocher, he's paying him in a fixed fee on barley. So when he plants wheat there, then the only beneficiary of the wheat is the worker, is the person who's working the field. The Balabayit gets nothing, and all he gets is a field that is in worse quality. So that is not allowed. But by a kablan, even though he's going to do something that will worsen the quality of the field or draw more heavily on the field, nevertheless, that drawing will produce wheat, which is a higher quality or a higher price crop, and the balabai will be the beneficiary. And we saw before, back on Daf Kuf Dalid, that the individual can make a claim, I'd rather you plant and hurt the land and make sure I get my money than you save the land and give me less money. So the balabai is always interested in a higher payout, despite how much it affects the land. If you give me a better payout or a better yield, then I'd rather have that than you worry about the quality of the land. That is Rashi's position. As you can see here in the Ot Dalet and the Gra, the Ramban and many other Rishonim write just the opposite. The Kablanut Asur Bechol Inyan. That by a sharecropper, he has no right to change it whatsoever. Because by Chakirut, you would have thought there's a possibility of changing it because he's promising him a fixed fee. Since he's being a fixed fee, it doesn't matter what he plants in the field as long as he lives up to giving his fixed fee. And number two is he doesn't hurt the balabais in doing so. That you have permission to do. So that's why Kolker can only downgrade and not upgrade, so he doesn't hurt the future value of the field. The Kablan has no right to change because the balabais is sharing in the output of the field and he's relying on this output. That means that if he agreed to plant barley, the balabait is counting on the barley here because either he has sold barley or he needs barley for his animals. There's a reason he wants barley. When you switch to chitim, even though it may give him a higher return, he was depending on exactly what you specified. And if he told you to plant chitim, that's what he wanted in the field. And so by a kablan, the Ramban believes just the opposite of Rashi, that you have no right to change it whatsoever. Rashi thinks it's all open to the kablan. Now they both agree that the Mishnah is speaking about a chocher. The question is, what's the implication for a kablan for an aris? Rashi says it means the aris can do whatever he wants. The Ramban says that the aris is bound by whatever he agreed to and he can't change at all. So Rashi believes in that case, if you're going to garner more money, the Baal HaBayit's all on board. It doesn't matter if you switch. On the other hand, the Ramban believes that the Baal HaBayit is depending and he wants this particular crop at his field and he doesn't have to go into the market and buy it. Even if you make him more money, whatever you agree to, that's what you're bound to. Amar Rav Chista, my time of the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shimon Gamliel where when he downgrades the crop and still pays him the fixed fee, why does the Baal HaBayit care? He gets a field in better quality in the end. The guy pays him his rental fee in the crop that he promised. And so he loses nothing. So why is it that he can't change according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? It says, Dichtiv, Sherit Yisrael lo yasu avla v'lo yidabru chazav v'lo yimatze b'fiem lashon tarmit. So here is a pasuk. It's a very, very important pasuk because it governs the way that people conduct themselves, which is that the remnant of Israel will not do things that are unjust. They will not lie and they will not have deception on their lips, which is that there's a demand that people be people of integrity, honesty, and upstanding. And that means if you tell someone you're going to do something, you do as you say, even though changing doesn't hurt the individual, doesn't affect them, they get what they were supposed to get anyway and have saved their field. Nevertheless, when you make a commitment, you have to stand by your commitment. You have to stand by what you say. And there Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says you can't change, period. You gave a commitment. You gave your word. Do what you say because that's a part and parcel of being a person with integrity. It's not lying or not changing what you said you would do, but standing by your word. And therefore, there's a demand, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, big Musar as well, that people act in a straightforward, honest manner that is full of integrity and that people stand by what their commitments are. That should be the hallmark of a Jew, this pasuk in Tzifanya. So Meitve, Migvat Purim lePurim, Ve'im Medaktukim B'davar. When we collect for Purim, it's used for Purim, but we're not careful about it. Ve'en Ani Rashad Lekach Me'em Ritzua LeSandalo. The Ani can't use the monies of Purim for personal benefit or personal usage, which means to buy his shoelace for his sandal. Elim kenitna ba ma'amad anshei ha'ir, divrei Rabbi Yaakov. Shamar mishum Rabbi Meir. Unless there was a specific request made of the public boards that he can do so. That is the word of Rabbi Yaakov in the name of Rabbi Meir. Mishimon Gamliel mekel. Mishimon Gamliel says, it's okay. Even if he changes it, people are not makpid on that. So the Gemara here has a problem. I'm not going to go into the details here of the Purim story. We dealt with that back on Ayin Chet Amud Bet over there as to what is going on in this Braita, as to what monies have to be dedicated to Purim. What does it mean that it has to be used for Purim? What does it mean that we're not careful? All those terms we defined back on Ayin Chet Amud Bet. But over here, the main focus is on Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who says that even though it was collected and given to this Ani for Purim, that he can use it for something else. Why don't we say the same thing in our Mishnah, which is, you can't change. You need to stand by your word. Someone gives you something to be used for a particular purpose, you need to use it for that purpose. Why is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel inconsistent in his position? So Rabbi Sabai says, no. Time of Rabbi Shimon, Kidmar. Rabbi Shimon's reasoning is not what you said, but rather, like Mar. Damar Mar. Ha'am manda nechale de titvorare. A person who wants his land to go fallow, meaning that he wants it to no longer be useful, to be drained. Lizra shata chite, in the first year plant wheat. Shata sare, the next year plant barley. Shata sheti, 1 year planted on the vertical. Shata erev, and 1 year on the horizontal. Each year change the crop, and each year change the direction in which you are planting. V'lo amran, elo delo kariv vitani. That's only if he doesn't plow it, and then plow it again. Of al kariv vitani, if he plows it and plows it again, late lamba, there is no problem. So now Rashi explains over here, first of all, damar mar, whenever you're speaking at Abaye, and he says amar mar, Abaye is Rebbeim, Rav Yosef, and Rabba. Generally, when he says amar mar, from Abaye, he's talking about Rabba bar Nachmani, that is his Rebbe, and that's what Rashi says over here, Rabba bar Nachmani, Rabbi de Abaye, the Rabba Gidlo Bebeito. Because Abaye was an orphan and Rabba brought him up in his house and therefore he refers to him as Mar. Number two is, Rashi says, if you want your field to be ruined, then you should do what is stated over here. So if you plant it, it's 1 year chitim, then the next year you go plant something else. The problem is that Rabbi Shimon Gilel says you don't know what he planted the previous year or what the Baal HaBayit wants here. And your changing the crop could affect the field, not because Se'orim, you're right, leaves the field in better condition, but Se'orim after Chitim could be detrimental. And so therefore you have another factor that has nothing to do with the draining of the nutrients of the field, but has to do with the sequential planting of crops. So first of all, you don't know what he planted last year, or you don't know what he intends to plant next year, and therefore what you plant this year will have an impact on the field that is unknown to you, and therefore you can't make a change. And that's what the reasoning behind Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is. The problem with this is the fact that the opposite is true, which is that generally crop rotation preserves the field and makes for a better yielding field. And therefore, if you don't plant the same crop each year, or you change the directions of the field, it should actually be more beneficial to the crop, to the field, rather than detrimental. Over here, they're saying if you stay with the same crop and plant the same direction, then that is more beneficial. That will keep the field intact. Whereas if you keep changing crops, that will ruin the field. Again, which is interesting because it took them a long time to figure that out in the Middle Ages in Europe. But once they did, they started doing crop rotation, or they started leaving parts of the fields fallow during a cycle of years in order to allow them to rejuvenate. But that would be just the opposite of what is being suggested over here. And Tosafot points that out. Tosafot is living in the Middle Ages in Europe, says, Beish bekunshish to tilkal kalasadeh, bekasho. Da'adarabah, kachu rigilut shalovdei adamash, zorim shana chitim shana seorim. That is exactly the practice of the people who have fields. Ukusho zorim otash, beit shanim chitin, yitzufim asorim mitkalkelet. If you plant the same crop 2 years in a row, it actually is detrimental. So Tosfot is saying we have evidence of just the opposite, which is that we're seeing that crop rotation is actually helpful. The Kakesh Lamar, the Tosfot says you have to say just the opposite, which is Manda Boy Shite Sadeu Chashuva, that a person who wants to make his field significant, Kilu Hinicha Shana Achad Bura, as if he laid it fallow for a year. Bura means to be fallow or to be unused. But you can have bura in two ways, Tosafot says. You can have bura because you left the field fallow and then it rejuvenates during that period of time. Or you can leave it fallow by planting a different crop. And that's what's meant by the Gemara. If you want your field to be as if it was left fallow, plant a different crop in the following year. Because that was the practice again in their time, which was to plant and then leave it fallow for the following year for it to rejuvenate and to replenish, and then they would plant it in the third year. So he says there is another way to do it, and that's crop rotation. And that's what's being suggested over here, according to the Baalei Tosafot, by Rabbah, is crop rotation. So the exact opposite of what we said about Rashi would be true now. If he's planting wheat, he asks you to plant wheat, that might be because he planted barley the previous year, or he plans on planting barley the following year, and that's why he wants wheat in particular. If you plant barley now, you're actually going to cause some problems in draining the field, either because he planted barley last year, or he plans to plant barley next year. And that's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shimon Gamliel saying it is asur. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Zayin Amud Aleph.